find out where he lived, what sort of private car he or his wife drove. But he'd do what he was told, because his own commercial activities thrived under Shablikov's protection. And later that night he'd go out drinking with Irina Aganovna, maybe take her to bed later, and along the way find out how deeply mourned Avseyenko was by his former employees.
"Yes, Comrade Polkovnik Leitnant," Klusov agreed, "it will be as you say. I will try to be back with you tomorrow."
"You will not try. You will do it, Pasha," Shablikov told him, like a schoolmaster demanding homework from an underachieving child.
"It is already underway," Zhang told his premier. "I trust this one will go more smoothly than its two predecessors," the premier replied dryly.
The risks attached to this operation were incomparably greater. Both previous times, with Japan's attempt to drastically alter the Pacific Rim equation, and Iran's effort to create a new nation from the ashes of the Soviet Union, the People's Republic had not done anything, just encouraged, behind the scenes. This venture, though, was different. Well, one could not really expect great things to happen on the cheap, could one?
We have been unlucky. Perhaps so.
A casual nod as he switched papers on his desk. Zhang Hansan's blood went a little cold at that. The Premier of the People's Republic was a man known for his detachment, but he'd always regarded his minister without portfolio with a certain degree of warmth. Zhang was one of the few whose advice the Premier usually heeded. As indeed today the advice would be heeded, but without any feeling on the part of the senior official.
"We have exposed nothing, and we have lost nothing," Zhang went on. The head didn't come up.
"Except that there is now an American ambassador in Taipei." And now there was talk of a mutual defense treaty, whose only purpose was to place the American Navy between the two countries, regular port visits, perhaps even a permanent base, to be built entirely, most certainly, from Taiwanese money, whose only purpose, the Americans would innocently say, was merely to be a replacement for Subic Bay in the Philippines. The economy on Taiwan had exploded after the renewal of full U.S. diplomatic recognition, with an influx of massive new capital investments from all over the world. Much of that money would, and should, have come to the PRC, except for the change in America's outlook. But the American President Ryan had taken his action entirely on his own, so the intelligence services claimed, contrary to political and diplomatic advice in Washington. Though the American Secretary of State, that Adler man, had reportedly supported Ryan's foolish decision. Zhang's blood temperature dropped another degree or so. Both of his plans had gone almost as he'd calculated they should, hadn't they? In neither case had his country risked anything of consequence. Oh, yes, they'd lost a few fighter aircraft the last time around, but those things and their pilots regularly crashed to no purpose anyway. Especially in the case of Taiwan, the People's Republic had acted responsibly, allowing Secretary Adler to shuttle directly back and forth between Beijing and its wayward province across the Formosa Strait, as though giving them legitimacy. Something obviously not intended by the PRC, but rather as a convenience to aid the American in his peacemaking task, so as to appear more reasonable to the Americans. And so why had Ryan done it? Had he guessed Zhang's play? That was possible. But it was more likely that there was a leak, an informer, a spy this close to the summit of political power in the People's Republic. The counterintelligence agencies were examining the possibility. There were few who knew what emerged from his mind and his office, and all of them would be questioned, while technical people checked his telephone lines and the very walls of his office. Had he, Zhang, been in error? Certainly not. Even if his premier felt that way. Zhang next considered his standing with the Politburo.
That could have been better. Too many of them regarded him as an adventurer with too great an access to the wrong ear. It was an easy thing to whisper, since they'd be delighted to reap the profits from his policy successes, and only slightly less delighted to pull away from him if things went awry. Well, such were the hazards of having reached the summit of policymaking in a country such as his.
Even if we wished to crush Taiwan, unless we opted for nuclear weapons, it would require years and vast amounts of treasure to construct the means to make it possible. And then it would be a vast risk to little profit. Better that the People's Republic should grow so successful economically that they come begging to us to be let back into the family home. They are not powerful enemies, after all. They are scarcely even a nuisance on the world stage.
But for some reason they were a specific nuisance to his premier, Zhang reminded himself, like some sort of personal allergy that marked and itched his sensitive skin.
We have lost face, Zhang. That is enough for the moment.
Face is not blood, Chu, nor is it treasure.
They have ample treasure, the premier pointed out, still not looking at his guest.
And that was true. The small island of Taiwan was immensely rich from the industrious effort of its mainly ethnic Chinese inhabitants, who traded nearly everything to nearly everywhere, and the restoration of American diplomatic recognition had increased both their commercial prosperity and their standing on the world stage. Try as he might, wish as he might, Zhang could not discount either of those things.
What had gone wrong, he asked himself again.
Were not his plays brilliantly subtle ones? Had his country ever overtly threatened Siberia?
No.
Did even the People's Liberation Army's leadership know what the plans were? Well, yes, he had to admit to himself, some did, but only the most trusted people in the operations directorate, and a handful of senior field commanders, the ones who would have to execute the plans if the time ever came. But such people knew how to keep secrets, and if they talked to anyone. But they wouldn't, because they knew what happened to people who spoke of things best left unspoken in a society such as theirs. And they knew that the very air had ears at their level of trust. They hadn't even commented on the draft plans to anyone, just made the usual adjustments in the technical arrangements, as senior officers always tended to do. And so, perhaps some file clerks had the ability to examine the plans, but that was exceedingly unlikely as well. Security in the PLA was excellent. The soldiers, from private to the lower general ranks, had no more freedom than a machine bolted to the factory floor. And by the time they reached senior rank, they'd mainly forgotten how to think independently, except perhaps in some technical matters, like which sort of bridge to build over a particular river. No, to Zhang they might as well have been machines, and were just as trustworthy. Back to the original question. Why had that Ryan fellow re-established relations with the Republic of China? Had he guessed anything about the Japan and Iran initiatives? The incident with the airliner had certainly looked like the accident it was supposed to simulate, and afterward the PRC had invited the American Navy to come to the area and keep the peace, as they liked to put it, as though peace were something you could place in a metal box and guard. In reality, it was the other way round. War was the animal you kept in a cage, and then released when the time suited. Had this President Ryan guessed the PRC's intentions to begin the dismemberment of the former Soviet Union, and then decided to punish the People's Republic with his recognition of the renegades on Taiwan? It was possible. There were those who found Ryan to be unusually perceptive for an American political figure. He was a former intelligence officer, after all, and had probably been a good one, Zhang reminded himself. It was always a serious mistake to underrate an adversary, as the Japanese and the Iranians had learned to their considerable sorrow.
This Ryan fellow had responded skillfully to both of Zhang's plans, and yet he hadn't so much as whispered his displeasure to the PRC. There had been no American military exercises aimed even indirectly at the People's Republic, no leaks to the American media, and nothing that his country's own intelligence officers operating out of the embassy in Washington had discovered. And so he was again back to the original question. Why had Ryan taken that action? He just didn't know. Not knowing was a great annoyance to a man at his level of government. Soon his premier might ask a question for which he needed to have the answer. But for now the leader of his government was flipping papers on his desk, ostensibly to tell him, Zhang, that he, the premier, was displeased. But not at this moment doing anything about his emotions. 10 meters away, through a solid core wood door, Lian Ming had her own emotions. The secretarial chair she sat in was an expensive one, purchased from Japan. The price of it equal to the wages of a skilled worker for, what, 4 months? 5? Certainly more than the price of the new bicycle she could have used. A university graduate in modern languages, she spoke English and French well enough to make herself understood in any city in the world. And as a result, she found herself going over all manner of diplomatic and intelligence documents for her boss, whose language skills were considerably less than her own. The comfortable chair represented her boss's solicitude for the way in which she organized his work and his day. And a little more. Chapter 2 The Dead Goddess. This was where it had all happened, Chester Nomori told himself. The vast expanse of Tiananmen Square, the square of heavenly peace, with the massive walls to his right, was like, what? On reflection, he realized that he had nothing with which to compare it. If there were another place in all the world like this place, he had neither visited nor even heard of it. And yet the very paving stones seemed to drip with blood. It was almost as if he could smell it here, though that was more than 10 years in the past. The massed students, not much younger than he had been at the time in California, rallying here to protest their government. They hadn't protested the form of their country's government so much as the corruption of those at its highest levels, and, predictably, such actions had been hugely offensive to the corrupted. Well, that's how it usually went. Only with discretion did one point out the nature of a powerful man to himself, Eastern or Western. But this was the most dangerous place of all, because of its long history of gross brutality. Here there was an expectation of it. But the first time it had been tried right here, the soldiers ordered to clear things up had balked. And that must have frightened the leadership in their plush and comfortable offices. Because when the organs of the state refused to do the bidding of the state, that was when something called revolution started. And in a place where there had already been a revolution, enshrined on this very spot. And so the initial troop formations had been pulled back and replaced with others, drawn from farther away. Young soldiers. All soldiers were young, Nomori reminded himself. They had not yet been contaminated by the words and thoughts of their contemporaries demonstrating in the square, not yet sympathetic with them, not yet willing to ask themselves why the government, which gave them their weapons and uniforms, wished for them to hurt these people instead of listening to what they had to say. And so they'd acted like the mindless automatons they'd been trained to be. There, just a few yards away, were some soldiers of the People's Liberation Army on parade, wearing the strange wax-doll look they tended to have, looking not quite human in their green wool uniforms. Almost as though they used makeup, Chet thought, wanting to look more closely at their faces to see if maybe they really did. He turned away with a shake of his head. He hadn't flown JAL to China for that. Wangling this assignment for Nippon Electric Company had been difficult enough.
It was a major drag working two jobs, as an upper-middle account executive for NEC and a field intelligence officer for CIA. To succeed in the second, he had also to succeed in the first, and to succeed in the first, he had to simulate a true Japanese salaryman, one who subordinated everything short of his breathing to the good of the company. Well, at least he got to keep both of his salaries, and the Japanese one wasn't all that bad, was it? Not at the current exchange rate, anyway. Nomori supposed that this whole deal was a great sign of confidence in his abilities. He'd established a modestly productive network of agents in Japan who would now report to other CIA case officers. And also of desperation. The agency had been singularly unsuccessful in getting a spy network operating over here in the PRC. Langley hadn't recruited many Chinese Americans into the fold, and one of those it had gotten was now in federal prison after having developed a serious case of divided loyalties. It was a fact that certain federal agencies were allowed to be racist, and today Chinese ethnicity was strongly suspect at CIA headquarters. Well, there wasn't anything he could do about that. Nor could he pretend to be Chinese himself, Nomori knew. To some half-blind racist European types, everyone with crooked eyes looked the same. But here in Beijing, Nomori, whose ancestry was 100% Japanese, albeit entirely of the Southern California variety, figured he stood out about as much as Michael Jordan would. It wasn't something to make an intelligence officer without diplomatic cover feel comfortable, especially since the Chinese Ministry of State Security was as active and well-supported as it was. MSS was every bit as powerful in this city as the Soviet KGB had ever been in Moscow, and was probably just as ruthless. China, Nomori reminded himself, had been in the business of torturing criminals and other unloved ones for thousands of years. And his ethnicity would not be overly helpful. The Chinese did business with the Japanese because it was convenient. Necessary was a more accurate term. But there was precisely zero love lost between the countries. Japan had killed far more Chinese in World War II than Hitler had killed Jews, a fact little appreciated anywhere in the world, except, of course, in China, and that set of facts only added to a racial, ethnic antipathy that went back at least as far as Kublai Khan. He'd gotten too used to fitting in. Nomori had joined CIA to serve his country, and to have a little fun, he'd thought at the time. Then he'd learned what a deadly serious business field intelligence was, followed by the challenge of slipping into places he wasn't supposed to be, of obtaining information he wasn't supposed to get, and then giving it to people who weren't supposed to know it. It wasn't just serving his country that kept Nomori in the business. There was also the thrill, the rush of knowing what others didn't know, of beating people at their own game, on their own turf. But in Japan, he looked like everyone else. Not here in Beijing. He was also a few inches taller than the average Chinese. That came from his childhood diet and American furniture. And better dressed in Western-style clothes. The clothes he could fix. His face he could not. For starters, he'd have to change his haircut, Chet thought. At least that way he could disappear from behind, and perhaps shake an MSS tail that way. He had a car to drive around, paid for by NEC, but he'd get a bicycle too, a Chinese make rather than an expensive European one. If asked about it, he'd say it was good exercise. And besides, wasn't it a perfectly fine socialist bicycle? But such questions would be asked, and notice of his presence would be taken. And in Japan, Nomori realized, he'd gotten slack and comfortable running his agents. He'd known that he could disappear in a place as intimate as a steaming bathhouse, and there talk about women and sports and many other things, but rarely business. In Japan, every business operation was secret at some level or other, and even with the intimate friends with whom he discussed their wives' shortcomings, a Japanese salaryman would not discuss goings-on in the office until after they were overt and public. And that was good for operational security, wasn't it? Looking around like any other tourist, he wondered how he would handle such things here. But most of all, he noticed that eyes lingered on him as he walked from one side of this immense square to the other. How had this place sounded when the tanks were here? He stood still for a moment, remembering. It was right there, wasn't it? The guy with the briefcase and shopping bag, who'd held up a company of tanks, just by standing there. Because even the private in the driver's seat of a Type 80 PRC tank didn't have the stones to run over the guy, despite whatever his captain might have been screaming at him over the interphones from his place on top of the turret. Yeah, it was right about here that had happened. Later on, of course, in about a week, the guy with the briefcase had been arrested by MSS, so said CIA's sources, and he'd been taken away and interrogated to see what had persuaded him to take so public and so foolish a political stand against both the government and the armed forces of his country. That had probably lasted a while, the CIA officer thought, standing here and looking around from the spot where one brave man had taken his stand. Because the MSS interrogators just wouldn't have believed that it had been one man acting on his own. The concept of acting on one's own was not something encouraged in a communist regime, and was therefore entirely alien to those who enforced the will of the state on those who broke the state's rules. Whoever he'd been, the guy with the briefcase was dead now. The sources were pretty clear on that. An MSS official had commented on the matter with satisfaction later on, before someone whose ears were distantly connected to America. He'd taken the bullet in the back of the head, and his family, a wife and an infant son, the source believed, had been billed for the pistol round needed to execute the husband, father, counter-revolutionary, enemy of the state, in question. Such was justice in the People's Republic of China. And what was it they called foreigners here? Barbarians. Yeah, Nomori thought. Sure, Wilbur. The myth of central position was as alive here as it had been on the coup d'etat of Adolf Hitler's Berlin. Racism was the same all over the world. Dumb. That was one lesson his country had taught the world, Chester Nomori thought, though America still had to absorb the lesson herself. She was a whore, and a very expensive one, Mike Riley thought from his seat behind the glass. Her hair had been unnaturally blonded by some expensive shop in Moscow. She needed another treatment, since there was a hint of dark brown at the roots. But it went well with her cheekbones and eyes, which were not quite any shade of blue he'd ever seen in a woman's eyes. That was probably a hook for her repeat customers, the color, he thought, but not the expression. Her body could have been sculpted by Phidias of Athens to be a goddess fit for public worship. Ample curves everywhere. The legs thinner than normal for Russian tastes, but ones that would have gotten along well at the corner of Hollywood and Vine, if that were still a nice neighborhood in which to be spotted. But the expression in her lovely eyes could have stopped the heart of a marathon runner. What was it about prostitution that did this to women? Riley shook his head. He hadn't worked that particular class of crime very often. It was mainly a violation for local cops, and not enough, he supposed, to understand its practitioners. The look in her eyes was frightening. Only men were supposed to be predators, so he and most men thought. But this woman belied that belief to a fare-thee-well. Her name was Tanya Bogdanova. She was, she said, 23 years of age. She had the face of an angel and the body of a movie star. It was her heart and soul the FBI agent was unsure of. Maybe she was just wired differently from normal people, as so many career criminals seem to be. Maybe she'd been sexually abused in her youth. But even at 23, her youth was a very distant thing, judging from the way her eyes looked at her interrogator. Riley looked down at her dossier folder from militia headquarters. There was only one shot of her in it, a distant black and white of her with a John. Well, probably an Ivan, Riley thought with a grunt. And in this photo her face was animated, youthful, and as alluring as the young Ingrid Bergman had been to Bogey in Casablanca. Tanya could act, Riley thought. If this were the real Tanya in front of him, as it probably was, then the one in the photo was a construct, a role to be played, an illusion. A wonderful one, to be sure, but potentially a highly dangerous lie to anyone taken in by it. The girl on the other side of the one-way mirror could have dug a man's eyeballs out with her nail file, and then eaten them raw before going to her next appointment at the new Moscow Four Seasons Hotel and Convention Center. "Who were his enemies, Tanya?" the militiaman asked in the interrogation room. "Who were his friends?" she asked in bored reply. "He had none. Of enemies he had many." Her spoken language was literate and almost refined. Her English was supposed to be excellent as well. Well, she doubtless needed that for her customers. It was probably worth a few extra bucks, D-marks, pounds, or euros. A nice hard currency for whose printed notes she'd give a discount, doubtless smiling in a coquettish way when she told her John, Jean, Ioannis, or Ivan about it. Before or after? Riley wondered. He'd never paid for it, though looking at Tanya, he understood why some men might. "What's she charge?" he whispered to Provalov. "More than I can afford," the detective lieutenant grunted. "Something like 600 euros, probably more for an entire evening. She is medically clean, remarkably enough. A goodly collection of condoms in her purse, American, French, and Japanese brands." "What's her background? Ballet, something like that?" the FBI agent asked, commenting implicitly on her grace. Provalov grunted in amusement. "No. Her tits are too big for that, and she's too tall. She weighs about, 55 kilos or so, I would imagine. Too much for one of those little fairies in the Bolshoi to pick up and throw about. She could become a model for our growing fashion industry, but, no, on what you ask, her background is quite ordinary. Her father, deceased, was a factory worker, and her mother, also deceased, worked in a consumer goods store. They both died of conditions consistent with alcohol abuse. Our Tanya drinks only in moderation. State education, undistinguished grades in that. No siblings, our Tanya is quite alone in the world, and has been so for some time. She's been working for Rasputin for almost 4 years. I doubt the Sparrow School ever turned out so polished a whore as this one. Grigory Filipovich himself used her many times, whether for sex or just for his public escort, we are not sure. And she is a fine adornment, is she not? But whatever affection he may have had for her, as you see, was not reciprocated. Anyone close to her? Provalov shook his head. None known to us. Not even a woman friend of note. The interview was pure vanilla, Riley saw, like fishing for bass in a well-stocked lake. One of 27 interrogations to this point concerning the death of G.F. Avseyenko. Everyone seemed to forget the fact that there had been 2 additional human beings in the car, but they probably hadn't been the targets. It wasn't getting any easier. What they really needed was the truck, something with physical evidence. Like most FBI agents, Riley believed in tangibles, something you could hold in your hand, then pass off to a judge or jury, and have them know it was both evidence of a crime and proof of who had done it. Eyewitnesses, on the other hand, were often liars. At best, they were easy for defense lawyers to confuse, and therefore they were rarely trusted by cops or juries. The truck might have blast residue from the RPG launch, maybe fingerprints on the greasy wrapping paper the Russians used for their weapons, maybe anything. Best of all would be a cigarette smoked by the driver or the shooter, since the FBI could DNA match the residual saliva on that to anyone, which was one of the Bureau's best new tricks. 600 million to 1 odds were hard for people to argue with, even highly paid defense attorneys. One of Riley's pet projects was to bring over the DNA technology for the Russian police to use. But for that, the Russians would have to front the cash for the lab gear, which would be a problem. The Russians didn't seem to have the cash for anything important. All they had now was the remainder of the RPG warhead. It was amazing how much of the things actually did survive launch and detonation, which had a serial number that was being run down, though it was doubtful that this bit of information would lead anywhere. But you ran them all down because you never knew what was valuable and what was not until you got to the finish line, which was usually in front of a judge's bench with 12 people in a box off to your right. Things were a little different here in Russia, procedurally speaking, but the one thing he was trying to get through to the Russian cops he counseled was that the aim of every investigation was a conviction. They were getting it, slowly for most, quickly for a few, and also getting the fact that kicking a suspect's balls into his throat was not an effective interrogation technique. They had a constitution in Russia, but public respect for it still needed growing, and it would take time. The idea of the rule of law in this country was as foreign as a man from Mars. The problem, Riley thought, was that neither he nor anyone else knew how much time there was for Russians to catch up with the rest of the world. There was much here to admire, especially in the arts. Because of his diplomatic status, Riley and his wife often got complimentary tickets to concerts, which he liked, and the ballet, which his wife loved. And that was still the class of the world. But the rest of the country had never kept up. Some at the embassy, some of the older CIA people who'd been here before the fall of the USSR, said that the improvements were incredible. But if that were true, Riley told himself, then what had been here before must have been truly dreadful to behold, though the Bolshoi had probably still been the Bolshoi, even then.
"That is all?" Tanya Bogdanova asked in the interrogation room.
"Yes, thank you for coming in. We may call you again."
"Use this number," she said, handing over her business card. "It's for my cellular phone."
That was one more Western convenience in Moscow for those who had hard currency, and Tanya obviously did. The interrogator was a young militia sergeant. He stood politely and moved to get the door for her, showing Bogdanova the courtesy she'd come to expect from men. In the case of Westerners, it was for her physical attributes. In the case of her countrymen, it was her clothing that told them of her newfound worth. Riley watched her eyes as she left the room. The expression was like that of a child who'd expected to be caught doing something naughty but hadn't.
"How stupid Father was," that sort of smile proclaimed.
It seemed so misplaced on the angel face, but there it was, on the other side of the mirror.
"Oleg?"
"Yes, Misha." Provolov turned.
"She's dirty, man. She's a player," Riley said in English.
Provolov knew the cop Americanisms.
"I agree, Misha, but I have nothing to hold her on, do I?"
"I suppose not. Might be interesting to keep an eye on her, though."
"If I could afford her, I would keep more than my eye on her, Mikhail Ivanich."
Riley grunted amusement.
"Yeah. I hear that. But she has a heart of ice."
"That's a fact," the FBI agent agreed.
and the game in which she was a player was at best nasty, and at its worst, lethal.
"So, what do we have?" Ed Foley asked, some hours later across the river from Washington.
"Garnished so far," Mary Pat replied to her husband's question.
"Jack wants to be kept up to speed on this one."
"Well, tell the president that we're running as fast as we can, and all we have so far is from the legal attaché. He's in tight with the local cops, but they don't seem to know shit either. Maybe somebody tried to kill Sergei Nikolaevich, but the legat says he thinks Rasputin was the real target."
"I suppose he had his share of enemies," the director of Central Intelligence conceded.
"Thank you," the vice president concluded to the packed house at the Ole Miss Fieldhouse. The purpose of the speech was to announce that 8 new destroyers would be built in the big Lytton shipyard on the Mississippi Gulf Coast, which meant jobs and money for the state, always items of concern for the governor, who was now standing and applauding as though the Ole Miss football team had just knocked off Texas at the Cotton Bowl. They took their sports seriously down here. And their politics, Robbie reminded himself, stifling a curse for this tawdry profession that was so much like medieval bargaining in a village square. 3 good pigs for a cow or something. Toss in a mug of bitter ale. Was this how one governed a country? He grinned as he shook his head. Well, there had been politics in the Navy, too, and he'd scaled those heights, but he'd done it by being one hell of a good naval officer, and the best fucking fighter pilot ever to catapult off a flat top. On the last score, of course he knew that every fighter pilot sitting and waiting for the cat shot felt exactly the same way. It was just that he was totally correct in his self-assessment. There were the usual hands to shake coming off the platform, guided by his Secret Service detail in their dark, forbidding shades, then down the steps and out the back door to his car, where another squad of armed men waited, their vigilant eyes looking ever outward, like the gunners on a B-17 over Schweinfurt must have done, the vice president thought. One of them held open the car door, and Robbie slid in. "Tomcat is rolling," the chief of the VP detail told his microphone as the car headed off. Robbie picked up his briefing folder as the car got onto the highway for the airport. "Anything important happening in D.C.?"
"Not that they've told me about," the Secret Service agent answered.
Jackson nodded.
These were good people looking after him. The detail chief, he figured, was a medium to senior captain, and the rest of his troops JGs to lieutenant commanders, which was how Robbie treated them. They were underlings, but good ones, well-trained pros who merited the smile and the nod when they did things right, which they nearly always did. They would have made good aviators, most of them, and the rest probably good Marines. The car finally pulled up to the VC-20B jet in an isolated corner of the general aviation part of the airport, surrounded by yet more security troops. The driver stopped the car just 20 feet from the foot of the self-extending stairs.
"You going to drive us home, sir?" the detail chief asked, suspecting the answer.
"Bet your ass, Sam," was the smiling reply.
That didn't please the USAF captain detailed to be co-pilot on the aircraft, and it wasn't all that great for the lieutenant colonel supposed to be the pilot in command of the modified Gulfstream 3. The vice president liked to have the stick, in his case the yoke, in his hands at all times, while the colonel worked the radio and monitored the instruments. The aircraft spent most of its time on autopilot, of course, but Jackson, right seat or not, was determined to be the command pilot on the flight, and you couldn't very well say no to him. As a result, the captain would sit in the back and the colonel would be in the left seat, but jerking off. What the hell, the latter thought. The vice president told good stories, and was a fairly competent stick for a Navy puke.
"Clear right," Jackson said a few minutes later.
"Clear left," the pilot replied, confirming the fact from the plane walker in front of the Gulfstream.
"Starting one," Jackson said next. followed 30 seconds later by starting two. The ribbon gauges came up nicely.
"Looking good, sir," the USAF Lieutenant Colonel reported. The G had Rolls-Royce Spey engines, the same that had once been used on the UK versions of the F-4 Phantom fighter, but somewhat more reliable.
"Tower, this is Air Force 2, ready to taxi."
"Air Force 2, Tower, cleared to taxiway 3.
"Roger, Tower AF2, taxiing via 3.
Jackson slipped the brakes and let the aircraft move, its fighter engines barely above idle, but guzzling a huge quantity of fuel for all that. On a carrier, Jackson thought, you had plane handlers in yellow shirts to point you around. Here you had to go according to the map/diagram, clipped to the center of the yoke, to the proper place, all the while looking around to make sure some idiot in a Cessna 172 didn't stray into your path like a stray car in the supermarket parking lot. Finally, they reached the end of the runway and turned to face down it.
"Tower, this is Spade requesting permission to take off."
It just sort of came out on its own.
A laughing reply.
"This ain't the Enterprise, Air Force 2, and we don't have cat shots here, but you are cleared to depart, sir."
You could hear the grin in the reply.
"Roger, Tower, AF2 is rolling."
"Your call sign was really Spade?" the assigned command pilot asked as the VC-20B started rolling.
"Got hung on by my first CO back when I was a new nugget, and it kind of stuck."
The vice president shook his head.
"Jesus, that seems like a long time ago."
"V1, sir," the Air Force officer said next, followed by VR.
At velocity rotation, Jackson eased back on the yoke, bringing the aircraft off the ground and into the air. The colonel retracted the landing gear on command, while Jackson flipped the wheel half an inch left and right, rocking the wings a little as he always did to make sure the aircraft was willing to do what he told it. It was, and inside of 3 minutes the G was on autopilot, programmed to turn, climb, and level out at 39,000 feet.
"Boring, isn't it?"
"Just another word for safe, sir," the USAF officer replied.
"Fucking trash hauler," Jackson thought. No fighter pilot would say something like that out loud. Since when was flying supposed to be... Well, Robbie had to admit to himself he always buckled his seatbelt before starting his car, and never did anything reckless, even with a fighter plane. But it offended him that this aircraft, like almost all of the new ones, did so much of the work that he'd been trained to do himself. It would even land itself. Well, the Navy had such systems aboard its carrier aircraft, but no proper naval aviator ever used it unless ordered to, something Robert Jefferson Jackson had always managed to avoid. This trip would go into his logbook as time in command, but it really wasn't. Instead, it was a microchip in command, and his real function was to be there to take proper action in case something broke. But nothing ever did. Even the damned engines. Once turbojets had lasted a mere 9 or 10 hours before having to be replaced. Now there were Spey engines on the G-fleet that had 12,000 hours. There was one out there with over 30,000 that Rolls-Royce wanted back, offering a free brand-new replacement because its engineers wanted to tear that one apart to learn what they'd done so right. But the owner, perversely and predictably, refused to part with it. The rest of the Gulfstream airframe was about that reliable, and the electronics were utterly state-of-the-art, Jackson knew, looking down at the color display from the weather radar. It was a clear and friendly black at the moment, showing what was probably smooth air all the way to Andrews. There was, as yet, no instrument that detected turbulence, but up here at flight level 390, that was a pretty rare occurrence, and Jackson wasn't often susceptible to air sickness. And his hand was inches from the yoke in case something unexpected happened. Jackson occasionally hoped that something would happen, since it would allow him to show just how good an aviator he was.
but it never did. Flying had become too routine since his childhood in the F-4N Phantom and his emerging manhood in the F-14A Tomcat. And maybe it was better that way. Yeah, he thought. Sure. Mr. Vice President? It was the voice of the USAF communications sergeant aboard the VC-20. Robbie turned to see her with a sheaf of papers. Yes, Sarge? Flash traffic just came in on the printer. She extended her hand, and Robbie took the paper. Colonel, your airplane for a while, the VP told the lieutenant colonel in the left seat. Pilot's airplane, the colonel agreed, while Robbie started reading. It was always the same, even though it was also always different. The cover sheet had the usual classification formatting. It had once impressed Jackson that the act of showing a sheet of paper to the wrong person could land him in Leavenworth Federal Penitentiary. At the time, actually, the since-closed Portsmouth Naval Prison in New Hampshire. But now, as a senior government official in Washington, D.C., he knew he could show damned near anything to a reporter from the Washington Post and not be touched for it. It wasn't so much that he was above the law, as he was one of the people who decided what the law meant. What was so damned secret and sensitive in this case was that CIA didn't know shit about the possible attempt on the life of Russia's chief spymaster, which meant nobody else in Washington did either. Chapter 3 The Problems with Riches. The issue was trade, not exactly the president's favorite. But then, at this level, every issue took on sufficient twists that even the ones you thought you knew about became strange at best, unknown and alien at worst. George, Ryan said to his Secretary of the Treasury, George Winston. Mr. Pres... God damn it, George! The president nearly spilled his coffee with the outburst. Okay. Sec-Trez nodded submission. It's hard to make the adjustment. Jack. Ryan was getting tired of the presidential trappings, and his rule was that here in the Oval Office his name was Jack, at least for his inner circle, of which Winston was one. After all, Ryan had joked a few times, after leaving this marble prison, he might be working for Trader, as the Secret Service knew him, back in New York on the street, instead of the other way round. After leaving the presidency, something for which Jack prostrated himself before God every night, or so the stories went, he'd have to find gainful employment somewhere, and the trading business beckoned. Ryan had shown a rare gift for it, Winston reminded himself. His last such effort had been a California company called Silicon Alchemy, just one of many computer outfits, but the only one in which Ryan had taken an interest. So skillfully had he brought that firm to IPO that his own stock holdings in SALC, its symbol on the big board, were now valued at just over $80 million, making Ryan by far the wealthiest American president in history. It was something his politically astute chief of staff, Arnold Van Dam, did not advertise to the news media, who typically regarded every wealthy man as a robber baron. Excepting, of course, the owners of the papers and TV stations themselves, who were, of course, the best of public-spirited citizens. None of this was widely known, even in the tight community of Wall Street big hitters, which was remarkable enough. Should he ever return to the street, Ryan's prestige would be sufficient to earn money while he slept in his bed at home. And that, Winston freely admitted, was something well and truly earned. And be damned to whatever the media hounds thought of it. "It's China?" Jack asked. "That's right, boss," Winston confirmed with a nod. Boss was a term Ryan could stomach, as it was also the in-house term the Secret Service, which was part of Winston's Department of the Treasury, used to identify the man they were sworn to protect. "They're having a little cash shortfall problem. And they're looking to make it up with us." "How little?" POTUS asked. "It looks as though it will annualize out to, oh, $70 billion or so. Well, that is, as we say, real money."
George Winston nodded. Anything that starts with a B is real enough, and this is a little better than 6 Bs a month.
Spending it for what?
Not entirely sure, but a lot of it has to be military-related. The French arms industries are tight with them now, since the Brits kiboshed the jet engine deal from Rolls-Royce.
The president nodded, looking down at the briefing papers.
Yeah, Basil talked the PM out of it.
That was Sir Basil Charleston, chief of the British Secret Intelligence Service, sometimes called, erroneously, MI6. Basil was an old friend of Ryan's, going back to his CIA days.
It was a remarkably stand-up thing to do.
Well, our friends in Paris don't seem to think the same way.
They usually don't, Ryan agreed.
The odd thing was the dichotomy inherent in dealing with the French. In some things, they weren't so much allies as blood brothers, but in others they were less than mere associates, and Ryan had trouble figuring out the logic by which the French changed their minds. Well, the president thought, that's what I have a State Department for.
So you think the PRC is building up its military again?
Big time. But not so much their navy, which makes our friends in Taiwan feel a little better.
That had been one of President Ryan's foreign policy initiatives after concluding hostilities with the defunct United Islamic Republic, now restored to the separate nations of Iran and Iraq, which were at least at peace with each other. The real reasons for the recognition of Taiwan had never been made known to the public. It looked pretty clear to Ryan and his Secretary of State, Scott Adler, that the People's Republic of China had played a role in the Second Persian Gulf War, and probably in the preceding conflict with Japan as well.
Exactly why?
Well, some in CIA thought that China lusted after the mineral riches in eastern Siberia. This was suggested by intercepts and other access to the electronic mail of the Japanese industrialists who'd twisted their nation's path into a not-quite-open clash with America. They'd referred to Siberia as the Northern Resource Area, hearkening back to when an earlier generation of Japanese strategists had called South Asia the Southern Resource Area. That had been part of another conflict, one known to history as the Second World War. In any case, the complicity of the PRC with America's enemies had merited a countermove, Ryan and Adler had agreed, and besides, the Republic of China on Taiwan was a democracy, with government officials elected by the people of that nation island, and that was something America was supposed to respect.
You know, it would be better if they started working their navy and threatening Taiwan. We are in a better position to forestall that than...
You really think so? Sectrez asked, cutting his president off.
The Russians do, Jack confirmed.
Then why are the Russians selling the Chinese so much hardware? Winston demanded. That doesn't make sense.
George, there is no rule demanding that the world has to make sense.
That was one of Ryan's favorite aphorisms.
That's one of the things you learn in the intelligence business.
In 1938, guess who was Germany's number one trading partner?
Sectrez saw that sandbag coming before it struck.
France?
You got it,
Ryan nodded.
Then, in 40 and 41, they did a lot of trade with the Russians.
That didn't work out so well either, did it?
And everyone always told me that trade was a moderating influence, the secretary observed.
Maybe it is among people, but remember that governments don't have principles so much as interests. At least the primitive ones. The ones who haven't figured it all out yet.
Like the PRC?
It was Ryan's turn to nod.
Yeah, George, like those little bastards in Beijing. They rule a nation of 1 billion people, but they do it as though they were the new coming of Caligula. Nobody ever told them that they have a positive duty to look after the interests of the people they rule.
Well, maybe that's not true, Ryan allowed, feeling a little generous.
They have this big, perfect theoretical model, promulgated by Karl Marx, refined by Lenin, then applied in their country by a pudgy sexual pervert named Mao.
Oh? Pervert?
Yeah.
Ryan looked up. We had the data over at Langley. Mao liked virgins. The younger the better. Maybe he liked to see the fear in their cute little virginal eyes. That's what one of our Peshrink consultants thought. Kinda like rape, not so much sex as power. Well, I guess it could have been worse. At least they were girls, Jack observed rather dryly. And their culture is historically a little more liberal than ours on that sort of thing. A shake of the head. You should see the briefs I get whenever a major foreign dignitary comes over. The stuff we know about their personal habits. A chuckle. Do I really want to know? A grimace. Probably not. Sometimes I wish they didn't give me the stuff. You sit them down right here in the office, and they're charming and businesslike, and you can spend the whole fucking meeting looking for horns and hooves. That could be a distraction, of course, but it was more generally thought that as in playing poker for high stakes, the more you knew about the guy on the other side of the table, the better. Even if it might make you want to throw up during the welcoming ceremony on the White House South Lawn. But that was the business of being president, Ryan reminded himself. And people actually fought like tigers to get there. And would again when he left, POTUS reminded himself. And so, Jack, is it your job to protect your country from the kind of rat who lusts to be where all the really good cheese is stored? Ryan shook his head again. So many doubts. It wasn't so much that they never went away. They just kept getting bigger all the time. How strange that he understood and could recount every small step that had led him to this office. And yet he still asked himself several times every hour how the hell he'd come to be in this place. And how the hell he'd ever get out. Well, he had no excuses at all this time. He'd actually run for election to the presidency. If you could call it that. Arnie Van Dam didn't, as a matter of fact. Which you could, since he'd fulfilled the constitutional requirements, a fact on which just about every legal scholar in the nation had agreed, and talked about on every major news network ad nauseam. Well, Jack reminded himself, I wasn't watching much TV back then, was I? But it all really came down to one thing. The people you dealt with as president were very often people whom you would never willingly invite into your home. And it had nothing to do with any lack of manners or personal charm, which, perversely, they usually displayed in abundance. One of the things Arnie had told Jack early on was that the main requirement to enter the political profession was nothing more or less than the ability to be pleasant to people whom you despised, and then to do business with them as if they were bosom friends. So what do we know about our heathen Chinese friends? Winston asked. The current ones, that is. Not much. We're working on that. The agency has a long way to go, though we are started on the road. We still get intercepts. Their phone system is leaky, and they use their cell phones too much without encrypting them. Some of them are men of commendable vigor, George. But none too terribly scandalous that we know about. Quite a few of them have secretaries who are very close to their bosses. The Secretary of the Treasury managed a chuckle. Well, a lot of that going around, and not just in Beijing. Even on Wall Street, Jack inquired, with a theatrically raised eyebrow. I can't say for sure, sir, but I have heard the occasional rumor. Winston grinned at the diversion. And even right here in this room, Ryan reminded himself. They'd changed the rug long since, of course, and all the furniture, except for the presidential desk. One of the problems associated with holding this job was the baggage piled on your back by previous office holders. They said the public had a short memory, but that wasn't true, was it? Not when you heard the whispers, followed by chuckles, and accompanied by knowing looks and the occasional gesture that made you feel dirty to be the subject of the chuckles. And all you could do about it was to live your life as best you could. But even then, the best you could hope for was for people to think you were smart enough not to get caught. Because they all did it, right?
One of the problems with living in a free country was that anyone outside this palace-slash-prison could think and say whatever he wished. And Ryan didn't even have the right that any other citizen might have to punch out whatever twit said something about his character that the twit was unwilling to back up. It hardly seemed fair. But as a practical matter, it would force Ryan to visit a lot of corner bars and break a lot of knuckles to little gain. And sending sworn cops or armed Marines out to handle matters wasn't exactly a proper use of presidential power, was it? Jack knew that he was far too thin-skinned to hold this job. Professional politicians typically had hides that made a rhinoceros's look like rose petals, because they expected to have things hurled at them, some true, some not. By cultivating that thick covering, they attenuated the pain somehow, until eventually people stopped hurling things at them, or such was the theory. Maybe it actually worked for some. Or maybe the bastards just didn't have consciences. You paid your money, and you took your choice. But Ryan did have a conscience. That was a choice he'd made long before. You still had to look in the mirror once a day, usually at shaving time, and there was no easy fix for not being able to like the face you saw there. "Okay, back to the PRC's problems, George," the president commanded. "They're going to juice up their trade. One way, that is. They're discouraging their own citizens from buying American, but all they can sell, they sell. Including some of Mao's young virgins, probably." "What do we have to prove that?" "Jack, I pay close attention to results, and I have friends in various businesses who shake the bushes and talk to people over drinks. What they learn frequently gets back to me. You know, a lot of ethnic Chinese have some weird medical condition. You get one drink into them, it's like 4 or 5 for us. And the second drink is like chugging a whole bottle of Jack Daniels. But some of the dummies try to keep up anyway. Some hospitality thing, maybe. Anyway, when that happens, well, the talk becomes freer, you know. It's been going on quite a while. But lately, Mark Gant set up a little program. Senior executives who go to certain special places... Well, I do own the Secret Service now, and Secret Service does specialize in economic crimes, right? And a lot of my old friends know who I am and what I do now, and they cooperate pretty nice. And so I get a lot of good stuff to write up. It mainly goes to my senior people across the street."
"I'm impressed, George. You cross-deck it to CIA?"
"I suppose I could, but I was afraid they'd get all pissy over turf rights and stuff."
Ryan rolled his eyes at that bit of information.
"Not Ed Foley. He's a real pro from way back, and the bureaucracy over at Langley hasn't captured him yet. Have him over to your office for lunch. He won't mind what you're doing. Same thing with Mary Pat. She runs the Directorate of Operations. MP's a real cowgirl, and she wants results, too."
"Duly noted."
"You know, Jack, it's amazing how much people talk, and the things they talk about under the proper circumstances."
"How'd you make all that money on the street, George?" Ryan asked.
"Mainly by knowing a little more than the guy across the street," Winston replied.
"Works the same way for me here."
"Okay, if our little friends go forward with this, what should we do?"
"Jack?" "No, now it's Mr. President. We've been financing Chinese industrial expansion for quite a few years now. They sell things to us, we pay cash for them. And then they either keep the money for their own purposes on the international money markets, or they purchase things they want from other countries, often things they could as easily buy from us, but maybe 0.5% more expensive from an American manufacturer. The reason it's called trade is that you theoretically exchange something of yours for something of the other guy's, just like kids with baseball cards, okay? But they're not playing the game that way. They're also dumping some products just to get dollars, selling items here for less than what they sell them to their own citizens. Now, that is technically in violation of a couple federal statutes." "Okay," Winston shrugged.
It's a statute we enforce somewhat selectively, but it is on the books, and it is the law. Toss in the Trade Reform Act that we passed a few years ago because of the games the Japs were playing.
I remember, George. It kind of started a little shooting war in which some people got killed, POTUS observed dryly. Worst of all, perhaps, it had begun the process that had ended up with Ryan in this very room.
Sectrez nodded.
True, but it's still the law, and it was not a bill of attainder meant only to apply to Japan. Jack, if we apply the same trade laws to China that the Chinese apply to us, well, it'll put a major crimp in their foreign exchange accounts.
Is that a bad thing?
No, not with the trade imbalance we have with them now. You know, Jack, if they start building automobiles and play the same game they're playing on everyone else, our trade deficit could get real ugly real fast. And frankly, I'm tired of having us finance their economic development, which they then execute with heavy equipment bought in Japan and Europe. If they want to trade with the United States of America, fine. But let it be trade. We can hold our own in any truly fair trade war with any country, because American workers can produce as well as anybody in the world and better than most. But if we let them cheat us, we're being cheated, Jack. And I don't like that here any more than I do around a card table. And here, buddy, the stakes are a hell of a lot higher.
I hear you, George.
But we don't want to put a gun to their head, do we?
You don't do that to a nation-state, especially a big nation-state, unless you have a solid reason for doing so.
Our economy is chugging along rather nicely now, isn't it? We can afford to be a little magnanimous.
Maybe, Jack.
What I was thinking was a little friendly encouragement on our part. Not a pointed gun, exactly. The gun is always there in the holster. The big gun is most favored nation status, and they know it, and we know they know it. TRA is something we can apply to any country, and I happen to think the idea behind the law is fundamentally sound. It's been fairly useful as a club to show to a lot of countries, but we've never tried it on the PRC.
How come?
POTUS shrugged, with no small degree of embarrassment.
Because I haven't had the chance yet. And before me, too many people in this town just wanted to kiss their collective ass.
Leaves a bad taste in your mouth when you do that, Mr. President, doesn't it?
It can, Jack agreed.
Okay, you want to talk this over with Scott Adler. The ambassadors all work for him.
Who do we have in Beijing?
Carl Hitch. Career FSO, late 50s, supposed to be very good. And this is his sunset assignment.
Pay off for all those years of holding coats?
Ryan nodded.
Something like that, I suppose. I'm not entirely sure. State wasn't my bureaucracy.
CIA, he didn't add, was bad enough.
It was a much nicer office, Bart Mancuso thought. And the shoulder boards on his undress whites were a little heavier now, with the 4 stars instead of the 2 he'd worn as comm-sub pack. But no more. His former boss, Admiral Dave Seaton, had fleeted up to Chief of Naval Operations, and then the President, or someone close to him, had decided that Mancuso was the guy to be the next Commander-in-Chief Pacific. And so he now worked in the same office once occupied by Chester Nimitz, and other fine, and some brilliant, naval officers since. It was quite a stretch since plebe summer at Annapolis, lo those many years before, especially since he'd had only a single command at sea, USS Dallas, though that command tour had been a noteworthy one, complete with 2 missions he could still tell no one about. And having been shipmates once and briefly with the sitting president probably hadn't hurt his career very much. The new job came with a plush official house, a sizable team of sailors and chiefs to look after him and his wife,